everyone. My name is Natalie Gochner. I'm in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and I am with my friends today in studio. On the left, Shireen Gourbani.
Hello, and hey, listeners.
And on the right, Senator Dan McKay.
So pleasant. She sounds like she's had so much sleep and is rested. She doesn't sound like she's suffering.
I don't work on Capitol Hill anymore.
I know.
Yeah, what's it like? Dan, tell us what it's
like. Well, the frenetic pace is in full swing. The last 2 weeks are just a blur, right?
Mm-hmm.
I literally, most days, I look at my watch or my phone to know what day it is, mm-hmm. right? So it cracks me up. I was like, well, hey, can you meet Wednesday? And I'm like, wait, that's Thursday? No.
What is it today?
What day is it? So that's the part we're at in this session.
For listeners that don't know, Senator McKay is involved in a lot of consequential legislation, and I'm just watching you go, Dan. Keep it up.
All right. Well, let's buckle up. Keep going.
Yeah. So, but we're going to go maybe to the little bit darker side right now and go to Washington, D.C. We had a UN vote. Maybe let's go to New York City for the UN vote.
Oh, yeah.
A resolution condemning the invasion of Ukraine. Russia, North Korea, Belarus, and the United States all opposed it. China and Iran stood on the sidelines. Goodness, Shireen.
Yeah.
Whatever it is in terms of chaos, flooding the zone, doing the unexpected, but this really caught a lot of people by surprise.
So give me your read on it, because I know that this is consequential, and I think it is.
I'm with Nikki Haley, who put out on X, you know, truth is truth, right is right, wrong is wrong. I don't think you do this.
Yeah.
Everyone will say it's a negotiating tactic. We do have President Zelensky in the White House this week, you know, to deal with some a deal on minerals, but I think it's not just what you do, but how you do it.
I think there's, no surprise to listeners, I'm about to become quite critical of our senators, Lee and Curtis, but I will say Senator Curtis came out on this, mm-hmm. Specifically expressing his concerns as well, right? In alignment, I guess.
Yeah.
I think this is a moment where things have become quite confused.
Yeah. Dan, I worry because you're so immersed right now in state public policy, but do you want to say anything on this?
Well, What I find is if Trump had sided on the sanctions and it caused further aggression in Russia and those kinds of things, there would have been a lot of condemnation of Trump's policy potentially of signing on and getting additional aggression. Trump not signing on and not getting additional aggression or not and trying to maintain a negotiation position, to me, that just tells me Trump is kind of damned if he does and damned if he doesn't on some of these things. It's pretty clear to me that Russia is not a friend to anyone, but there's also, potentially an acknowledgement of, hey, this thing's close to over. And is there a way that we can bring people together? I think about, and obviously I know people reject me, comparing Trump to Abraham Lincoln. I'm not saying they're the same, but I remember this, the political decision after the Civil War. Lincoln was in a reconciliation mode and pardoned all the people that fought and, didn't put, people that had fought or killed or done whatever war crimes. He didn't extend any of that stuff to extend the fight. And maybe Trump is in a position, and his administration is in a position like, okay, this thing's almost over. Can we just get out?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's the position. I'm trying to come up with a benefit.
Let's watch over the next several weeks. We also have Zelensky in town. This is sort of a lot of people, Dan, have been commenting about how this feels like extortion. Like while someone's at war, you're saying, we'll give you aid, but you got to pay for it.
Well, Ukraine has not been a friendly nation to the United States in recent history. Mm-hmm. It was just Russia invading them. It's kind of our enemy of our enemy is our friend,
mm-hmm.
is how we became embroiled in the Ukrainian-Russia conflict.
And supporting a democracy.
Yeah, supporting a democracy.
Fragile democracy. Yeah,
and very fragile, right? Because they didn't even need to hold elections, apparently. But that being said, like you look at the problems that are in that relationship. And I can understand why the United States is trying to get to a post-war position with Ukraine that is a better relationship than we had before.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You are being really patient, Shireen. You're just holding your mouth.
I know.
Do you want to go to Medicaid cuts?
Yes,
or do you want...
let's do it.
Okay.
So over just the last couple of days, so we're recording this on Wednesday, the House GOP narrowly approved a budget framework that includes massive cuts mm-hmm. to Medicaid. And this in particular is $880 billion over a decade from Medicaid, threatening the health care coverage of more than 72 million people. And I need to be really clear with listeners. Every single one of your representatives in Congress is okay with this. They're also okay with cuts to SNAP. So now I'm not sure where it's going to be at, but if you are concerned about this, you can call your senators. But I just want to put a little bit of color on it. This is 1 in 10 Utahns, so 11% rely on Medicaid as their primary insurance. The majority of those are children. This is taking healthcare coverage from kids to pay for tax cuts for billionaires. That is what's happening.
Yeah. So I'm surprised that they've gone here. Dan, I've watched as DOGE has done its cost cutting. And I'm like, they got to get to entitlements. They got to get to, you know, the big budget items.
Right.
So now here they are
on
a big budget item. But my goodness, I would have started with Social Security.
Well, and let's pause on that because the cuts that we're seeing roll out from DOGE, which I'm just like irritated I have to say that at all. When we talk about the federal workforce, we are talking about 33,000 Utahns that work for the federal government. These are real people. There has been devastating reporting in the Salt Lake Tribune, an individual, a veteran who, a disabled veteran who finally got his dream job with a VA position cut. These are real people, right?
Yeah.
I think that there is something absolutely disgusting about this, but the thing that I think is more troubling, do you know the percentage of salaries for federal workers represents in our overall federal budget?
It's got to be infinitesimally small.
It is. I know it's less than 4%.
Why Medicaid? In other words, this is children and this is poor children.
Mm-hmm.
And so that we're talking about our future here. And I'm like, why don't you just raise the retirement age and Social Security for 20-year-olds? And over time, you know, you're living longer, you have modern health care, and it seems more fair.
There's policy and then there's politically possible, right? Mm-hmm. Is what I think it comes down to. The crazy thing, I agree with you. If you remember George W. Bush back when, you know, we kind of had a quote mandate against Al Gore, which I would obviously say that wasn't necessarily a mandate. Mm-hmm. But when you think back to George W. Bush, that was one of the big things that he ran on was, hey, we're going to reform Social Security. And I did the math and I've seen recent reports out of the GAO and others. The interesting thing about Social Security is if a person who is now collecting Social Security had taken a similar amount and invested it in their employer's 401k program, as opposed to, you know, in a mandatory match or even in a mandatory deposit program or something, they would be receiving close to $16,000 a month in payments from those Social Security payments if they match that same amount. Hold on. But I say, I look at that and it's like, okay, what we've done is we've created an insurance program for retirement that is actually a welfare program because in some ways it's significantly less payment than they would have received if they'd been in a 401. And that 401 performance could have been taxed or done whatever and, you know, help backstop the need for the poor and some of those. That I remember this just because I was a staffer in D.C. back looking at, you know, trying to look at ways to reform Social Security back in the day.
Mm-hmm. But I have to ask this because I know.
But I wouldn't have started at Medicaid.
I know that you grew up less than paycheck to paycheck, which I did too. You think your parent would have had the ability to put aside that kind? Like I've heard this number thrown around like, oh, if they could have put it in a 401k, there was no way that would have happened in my family. And I know it wouldn't have happened in
yours
either.
But they did do it in their paycheck with Social Security. That's all I'm saying is if they take
FICA
the
happened.
Same. Yeah. If they take the same FICA payments and instead of putting them into a government program that then pays much less than they would have if that FICA was a forced savings in a 401k at a market, you know, I don't even if you did it at a treasury note or if you did it at like at a very conservative investment level, they would be better off than Social Security would have been today.
I just want to add this is 20% of children living in rural areas in this state. And when we think about the impact that this is going to have on rural hospitals, it's devastating.
Yeah, I don't agree with
potentially
Steve.
Just give it time. Like all I'm saying is, you are not going to touch the third. You're not going to be able to touch the rail and not get shocked, the third rail, right? Mm-hmm. And Medicaid, you know. But at the end of the day, non-discretionary expenses in D.C., they have to
be touched. I don't agree with Steve Bannon very often, but he doesn't like these Medicaid cuts. He's reminded his listeners how many MAGA supporters are Medicaid recipients. So stay tuned on that.
And I will say, I do believe that the course of Medicaid as it is currently is going to a single payer program, we're just going in the slowest, most painful possible route. And I think that's what the Dems want.
In our last couple of minutes, let's talk about Doge and Elon Musk just for a bit. This week, Elon Musk had a seat at the cabinet table with all of the Senate-confirmed cabinet members.
I think you may be the only one in the room who's been at one of those meetings.
Well, I took a pause, you know, seeing that. But also, Shireen, we had 21 Doge staffers who quit because of their opposition to this dismantling of the federal government.
Yes, of core programs that support people, right? So tell me about why it stood out to you that Elon Musk was at this cabinet meeting.
Well, when you go to the White House is very small. There's not a lot of rooms. It's, you know, it's more traditional than anything. And you have a room called the cabinet room. And every seat in that around that table has the names of everyone who's been in that seat. So Secretary of Energy or Secretary of Education. And there's not really a seat for a special government employee. Mm-hmm. So I think it defied a lot of norms.
Yeah.
That said, you have a lot of visitors that speak at those cabinet meetings. It isn't generally always the cabinet speaking, right?
He was specifically asked, did he have a seat at the table, you know, in his role? And he did. And I don't think this will last for much longer.
It'd be interesting. I thought it was interesting. He's in a T-shirt and a sport coat, and a hat, which is not generally, you know, that's not cabinet room dress.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is a person who is an unelected official, right? So the everyone sitting around that table is Senate approved. This person is simply not.
Yeah. Really interesting. Okay. We got a lot more to talk about. And Dan, we're going to lean into you about the legislative session and the judiciary. We want to talk about that in our next section. So stay tuned, everyone.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gourbani on the left.
And Dan McKay, gently, lovingly supporting Shireen on the right.
I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center, and I hope our friendship comes through the airwaves.
Yeah.
We have a listener to thank,
Shireen. We have a listener to thank. Deanna wrote in, and I really feel you, Deanna. I think that this is a person who's feeling pretty overwhelmed by the news, maybe somebody a little more left-leaning. But one of the pieces of feedback we got was that Dan's quite, maybe even a little snide, a little aggressive. And I'll just say, even though it's difficult to believe, we deeply disagree on politics. Yeah. And I think we have, oddly, some weird shared worldview things, but have a lot that we see really differently.
But I really do like Shireen.
And we really do continue to stay in conversation. And I actually would invite you, Natalie, to talk a little bit about, you had an interesting experience this morning that I think reinforces this notion that we do need to keep talking to each other.
You know, we saw that... I was with a 4-star general last week.
Oh.
And yeah, it was just kind of interesting. Yeah. They're differentiated the way they hold themselves, the language they use. But he used the term for the good of the order. And then he would say something. And I'd never heard that term, for the good of the order. And anyway, it just sort of stuck with me. I spent the morning with Yuval Levin. Yuval is a political theorist from the American Enterprise Institute. Yeah. He wrote the book American Covenant.
Right.
But he has a lot of optimism about how
such a good book.
It's a great book. Mm-hmm. If we can learn to disagree in a more accommodating way, we can unify. Mm. And you're hearing that word accommodation more. And it basically just means like hear the other side, you know, listen to it, understand their point of view, state it back to them, and then also add yours and see if you can't get to a better place. And he thinks our Constitution paves the way for that by having competing factions do their thing.
Yeah.
So for the good of the order.
For the good of the order. What's next? Yeah.
Well, I want to talk about...
I'm not going to lie. That does sound like something right out of a Star Wars episode. You know, Empire has
Anyway. And leave it to a political theorist.
Leave it to the... Yeah. So
I grew up Catholic adjacent, and it feels Catholic to me.
There you go.
Interesting. Okay. Dan, Shireen and I both want to talk to you about this apparent war on the judiciary that feels like is happening up here. Well, it's this idea that... We in retention elections, judges now would have to hit 67%, you know, that the Chief Justice would be appointed and confirmed by the governor and Senate, and that the legislature would have a ability to post, you may be on the ballot, whether they were recommended by the legislature.
Yeah.
I don't know, friend.
That's great. That's
yeah, I don't
awesome.
Know. I mean, that to me, that right. there's some expansion so my of favorite, legislative my favorite power
like,
there.
My favorite is like you've got the three branches of government. Okay, I'm in a little quiz for everybody. Mm. You have three branches of government in the state of Utah, and the three branches of government coexist, and they're meant to be a check and balance on each other. I think the check and balance on the governor and the legislative branch, those two check each other in ways that are meaningful and obvious to people.
Give me a recent example.
Well,
I would just say the legislature's grabbed quite a bit of power from the
yeah,
governor.
But the governor vetoes. The governor has, I would say the governor in a lot of ways, this governor is much more active on the policy end than the governors that I've dealt with in the past. And so and by active, I mean, it's not uncommon for me to get a text while he's reading bills at 11 o'clock at night saying, really? You know, it's not uncommon. And then I'm like, OK,
I think it really isn't a check, but go yeah. on. OK,
no, but in some ways it is right. Because, you know, he's not only communicating to you. So it's like, how do you OK, what can I do about this to make it better? Right. Okay. So but I think that veto that's obvious. Mm-hmm. I don't know, other than the appointment process and how people are appointed. I don't think people are as familiar with the 19 references in the Utah Constitution of the legislative checks on the judicial branch, literally mm-hmm. in the Utah Constitution.
That already exists.
That exist right now and by the way, we're not implementing them. We're not using them. And so while this feels like this, quote, war on the judiciary, I don't mm-hmm. know that that's necessarily the case. I think you see the legislative branch pushing back mm-hmm. on the natural balance that the Utah Constitution provides.
So I'm going to go look those up and let's yeah. talk about them again.
Okay. I'm happy to give a list. I'm not going to read it for the listeners.
Dan, I learned something interesting. I don't know if this, but Yuval Levin in his commentary today, he talked about how separation of power is not power singular, but powers plural,
right.
referencing that each of them have a different power. And he did this interesting. He said the courts are power over the past. They're mm-hmm. looking at the past and saying, is it, you know, constitutional? Yeah. The legislature's power for the future,
right?
Because you're setting policy, and the governor's power for the present because you're executing here and now. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. I just want to
articulation. Isn't that interesting?
It is interesting. And if you haven't seen the reporting on this issue, I recommend that people look it up. We could probably put it in the show notes as well. But it's not you, Natalie, that's saying there's a war on the judiciary. Mm-hmm. It's them. And there are a number
of reasons. The judges
are saying
the judges.
Yeah, and there's sure. a number of reasons to consider retribution, considering unfavorable rulings on this present-looking, I guess, body yeah. that is passing stuff that seems to be unconstitutional.
Yeah. So, Dan, Shireen's very clever. Yeah, I think you and I can both agree on that. I talked to her about the vote-by-mail bill, and she quickly snapped, solution in search of a problem.
Yeah. So I think,
so
you know,
to our listeners, like yeah. this bill has gone all over the place, but we now have a vote-by-mail bill that requires you to opt in to submit ballots through mail and elect to receive a ballot at your home. So we're still going to have vote-by-mail, but there's just a higher bar to
entry. And I think, Dan, I know you're not really one of the people advancing this legislation, so it's difficult to ask you why. But when I see a state that is a super majority Republican state, when I know that county after county is fully represented by Republicans, I don't understand why we need to create tactics to suppress the vote in this state.
Well, I reject the idea that it is a suppression. But what I will say is, we do not have a great tool to keep our voting records clear, and we don't have a good mechanism or resource to, you know, have a quality check against our process. And I think what you see is everybody realizing, hey, there are things we can do. And the pendulum swings on these issues all the time. It swung all the way to where you could do same day voter registration. And what we ended up doing was we ended up lengthening the amount of time by like weeks, the amount of time it took for, you know, for the counties to verify
canvas.
Verify the canvas. Right. And so everybody's saying, well, you know, sure, it'd be nice if voters knew there's a deadline and they just registered a little bit earlier. Right. It's not that hard. You know, America's never meant to be cheap and easy. Right. So I think the balance that we're trying to strike is make sure we can get the same quality and the same, you know, as best we can participation. And at the same time, you know, provide security for people who feel like it is insecure.
Yeah.
And I think this is a good step because I think in the long run, we're going to get to, you know, 20, 30 years from now, who knows? We're going to get to a point where digital voting And
can't wait.
And having, you know, just having that kind of level of participation, it's going to bring with it its own security issues.
Our money's all digital. Let's make our votes digital.
Well, in Estonia, Estonia is the first country really to go to a nationwide vote for digital voting.
I just want to go back and note that we do have an audit process that happens at the county level. The county clerks do audit each vote, right? And then there was an audit on our voting here in the state that was run. I think it was out of the state auditor's office that showed that we have basically no voter fraud. And one of the things that I think is concerning about this is we're also seeing legislation advanced here a little later than the rest of the country attacking ERIC, which is the system that does a voter verification to understand if we have voter fraud or people voting across multiple states. And there's a bill now to dismantle our participation
in
that.
But you remember in that audit, there was the key footnote that is really interesting for all of us is if there was fraud, we have no way to fix it. There's no remedy if there was fraud. And that's the issue that we're trying to deal with is there is no remedy. Once the ballot has and the signature process has been validated, there's no way to go back and fix it. And you can't.
Yeah. Okay. I've got a few others I want to hit on. And Shereen, I have to go to Dan first on this one because it's a public finance issue. But this, I called it clever off the air, but this SB 37 property tax money that's going to come in and now go to the general fund and then use the income tax to do the things that the property tax has been doing. Our school financing is so complicated in this state. But Dan, clever, because as I think of it, the legislature's wanted more flexibility for the longest time with the school fund. The public has not given it to them in full. And so now you just, by doing this, the public, you got what you wanted, I guess. So to our listeners, we have a state mandated property tax.
Yeah.
Every district must charge it. So it's like a state tax, but it's used for education. The state's now going to take, if this gets signed by the governor, mm-hmm. take that state mandated portion and use it and therefore free up income tax monies.
And necessity is the breed of all invention, right? So
who thought of this?
I'm just going to say that it was. This is one way to kind of shore up some differences in our budget, and try and deal with some of this flexibility in a way that is constitutionally possible. I don't know that you'll see in the long or the short term, significant changes to how we do the
budget. Totally agree.
Now.
I totally agree. Shereen, that should be comforting to you. Like this
it just
is
takes the pressure.
Behind the scenes, but it gives them more flexibility. Should they need it? And it takes that off the...
Yeah, should we trust them? So I just want to add a couple of quick things on this.
I don't.
But the question was, just a couple of episodes ago, you told me when we were talking about if people receive the civics education that they need, you told me we spend $8,000 per student. But the current number that's set for 2025 is $4,500. So I just want to make sure listeners know that. And when I look at...
But Shereen, you're only capturing the state mandate.
I know, but I'm
you're
just saying
missing out on the local effort. The local effort is
it
at
varies
least
by
double
district.
That.
It varies by district.
But it's double that.
But I'm saying that's your portion of it. Then I also just have to add, when we look at the way that these dollars go and the amount of dollars that have been funneled into private vouchers and private school agendas in this state, with a reminder that over 95% of folks choose their neighborhood school as their school, their public school as their school. We are talking about millions of dollars. So about $100 million that's already been designated and then a request for another $80 million. To go into these private vouchers this year. I don't know exactly where that's going to go, but when we think about opportunities to do things like pay off student lunch debt, that would be $1.6 million. Free school lunch for low-income students, that's $5 million. And one that really stands out to me, I think something that I would love to see prioritized, is something like enough school psychologists to meet professional standards, which is a big money ask, but that would be $100 million. But those are the kinds of dollars we give to private vouchers, and I just
Sounds
would ask
like
if
Shereen
that aligns.
Should run for the legislature, Dan. Did you hear
I don't want to, but I just want to know if that
numbers.
Aligns. If
like
that
she
aligns
lives
with
in the avenue,
you
could be elected. You could be elected.
I could be elected on my block.
Hey, okay. Fluoride. Shereen, Dan, I didn't realize this was going to hit this year. It looks like it's passed both the House and the Senate, going to the governor for signature. I mean, Shereen is worried about this. She's done her research.
Yeah.
I think that it's... There's got to be other ways for people who want fluoride to get the fluoride they want. And if you don't want it, yeah, it's your choice. But
well, and there have been discussions about using fluoride filters and fluoride additions to school water, right? Mm-hmm. So that's where kids are getting most of their water anyways, and using that kind of thing. So maybe there's a, maybe some opportunities there. We're looking at some of those options. But what, the crazy thing is, it really wasn't about necessarily just the forced medication part of it. That was a part of it, but it's not, that's not all of it. The bigger part of it was the infrastructure that it requires to support fluoride, and the fact that we have so many systems that are having a hard time regulating the amount of fluoride that gets in the water because of how our water system is designed. Millions we would have to do to fix it.
I see. Shireen, give us an alternative point of view.
I had a couple of conversations with my dentist and then also with a pediatrician who practiced here before water was fluorinated and then post. And I would just encourage people to have those conversations with the healthcare providers if they're lucky enough to have access to them, to hear what they had to say. My dentist said something quite clever, which was, when the actual group that stands to financially benefit from this is lobbying against it, it should tell you something.
Yeah, interesting. They're saying that the money would come to them if
fixing teeth.
Yeah, yeah, that's really interesting. Well, you two, for the good of the order, I'm going to call that a wrap. Dan McKay, Shireen Gourbani, Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. Our program is produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.